This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, the 20th of February, 2007. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado. With a fresh wave of escalated violence in Baghdad, we'll look into Bush's escalation in Iraq.
It gets more difficult every day. They're relying on people who have already served in Iraq once or twice. And a lot of these guys, when they first went to Iraq, they really thought that they were liberators. And now they're being faced a third time. Their family members are saying, well, I don't know you anymore. Who are you?
Homeless advocates say new federal grants to provide support simply don't go far enough.
Every unit of government should be doing something, and the federal government should be doing a help a lot more.
And the case of Lewis Scooter Libby wraps up in Washington, D.C. All that and more on today's newscast, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. A federal appeals court panel has ruled 2-1 against dozens of detainees at the Guantanamo Bay prison camp who are attempting to gain access to U.S. civilian courts. Lawyers for the detainees argued that the Military Commissions Act of 2006 fundamentally violates the Constitution and illegally suspends the 800-year-old legal precedent of habeas corpus. Under the system of trial by military commission, the accuser acts as the interrogator, prosecutor, judge, jury, and jailer. Many legal experts watching this case see today's ruling as another step in the journey towards the Supreme Court. At least 16 people have died and 40 others have been wounded as Ethiopian and Somali government troops exchanged heavy artillery fire with unidentified assailants overnight in the rest of Somali capital. Abdurrahman Warsame reports from Mogadishu.
The mortar fire began at around 2:40 this morning with rounds directed at Villa Somalia, the presidential residence in Mogadishu, where Ethiopian and Somali troops are stationed to protect the president. The soldiers responded by firing heavy cannons and mortars, which landed on civilian homes in different neighborhoods in the city, including the camps of internally displaced people. Dr. Dahir Muhammad from the Medina Hospital told reporters that the facility has received 40 injured people, many of whom are very seriously wounded by shrapnel. No one has claimed responsibility for the latest attack, but a group calling itself the Popular Resistance Movement in the Land of Two Migrations has said it is behind a recent spate of attacks on Ethiopian and Somali government soldiers in Mogadishu and elsewhere in Somalia. Meanwhile, many families have been moving out of Mogadishu in recent days as violence escalates in the city. For FSRN, this is Abdurrahman Warsame in Mogadishu.
A provincial government minister in Pakistan was assassinated today at a political meeting by a convicted serial killer. FSRN's Masroor Hussein has more.
The social welfare minister for the province of Punjab, Zille Huma, was shot in the forehead today as he approached a podium to deliver a speech at a public event. Zille Huma belonged to the ruling Pakistan Muslim League Party and was an active promoter of women's rights within Pakistani society. The minister's bodyguards caught the suspected gunman, who has been identified as Ghulam Sarwar. Sarwar has a criminal record of deadly violence against women. He was jailed last year for killing some 12 sex workers in Lahore, but released soon after. No reason was offered by the authorities for letting go a serious offender. The minister's assassination comes at a time in which the law and order situation in Pakistan has worsened as a result of army's attacks on the conservative tribal areas along the border with Afghanistan. Masroor Hussain, Free Speech Radio News, Islamabad.
Jubilee USA, a network that advocates for debt relief for impoverished countries, today kicks off a public pressure campaign aimed at a private company set to make millions off of speculation with Zambia's debt. Nan McCurdy has more from Washington, D.C.
In 1999, Donegal International paid $3.3 million for a debt of $15 million owed by Zambia. Now Donegal has sued Zambia for the full amount plus interests and costs, a whopping $55 million. On February 15th, a British court rejected the size of Donegal's vulture fund claim, but said that under law it is entitled to something, and it could be as much as $20 million. Debbie Carr, Communications and Advocacy Coordinator at Jubilee USA.
This problem of vulture funds is one that many impoverished countries around the world that have gotten access to 100% debt cancellation currently face. And with this money, we've already seen how much the government could do for the social sector in Zambia. And that's why we're calling on people today to please call Donegal International to tell them that they need to call off their vultures and stop suing the Zambian government for this money to enable them to provide for their people.
A British judge is due to determine the amount Zambia owes Donegal International sometime next month. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nan McCurdy.
In Queens, New York, the family of Sean Bell ended a 50-day vigil outside of a New York police precinct. Abdullahi Ba reports.
On Monday, protesters gathered outside the 103rd precinct in Jamaica to protest the shooting of Sean Bell, who was shot and killed by the New York Police Department about 3 months ago. Demonstrations have been held for 50 consecutive days to symbolize the 50 shot that ended the life of Sean Bell in the early morning hours of his wedding day in November 2050 of last year. The march ended with a service at the church where Bell was to be married. Bell's family want to keep attention on the case as a grand jury considers whether to indict the officers involved in the shooting and to call for a special prosecutor. A decision is not expected until March. This is Abdullahi Ba reporting from New York for Free Speech Radio News.
Mexico's Supreme Court has approved the formation of a commission to investigate human rights abuses committed last year in the town of San Salvador Atenco. The town was the scene of a brutal police crackdown against Zapatista sympathizers and farmers who had successfully defended their land from a federal expropriation attempt. Thousands of federal and state riot police smashed through the town on the morning of May 4, 2006, arresting over 200 people, many in warrantless house raids. Both Amnesty International and Mexico's National Human Rights Commission found evidence that police raped or sexually assaulted at least 24 women after their arrest. The Supreme Court clarified that their commission is not to prosecute human rights violators, but rather to identify which human rights were violated and how to establish criteria for police behavior during mass arrests. And those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The closing arguments in the I. Lewis Scooter Libby trial were held today in Washington. The case involves the outing of a CIA operative known as Valerie Plame, the wife of a former Bush administration official who questioned evidence in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. Libby was a top aide to Vice President Cheney. Our Leanne Caldwell is at the U.S. District Courthouse in Washington, D.C. So, Leanne, what is the prosecution's case?
Well, the prosecution today in their closing arguments is summarizing up the entire trial. And they're using contradictions in witnesses' testimony with Libby's testimony before the grand jury last year. They say there were eight people that we questioned, nine conversations, and they don't match up.
What do you mean by these contradictions?
These contradictions, some of them involve conversations Libby had with reporters about the identity of CIA operative known as Valerie Plame, which is what we'll continue to call her for identification's sake today. Libby says he doesn't remember talking about Plame with reporters. Those reporters include NBC's Tim Russert and also Time Magazine's Matthew Cooper and also New York Times reporter Judith Miller. The reporters, on the other hand, say he did. He actually did bring up the name of Valerie Plame to them and talked about that information with them.
And what's been the defense's response to all of this?
Well, the defense is saying Libby has been a busy man. Libby, in his grand jury testimony, has said that he doesn't remember having these conversations or he doesn't remember talking about this with those reporters. Like I said, the defense is saying Libby is a busy man. The defense also says that this is a he said, she said kind of case. It's one person's testimony against the other, and you're going to have to believe one side or the other. They're trying to discredit the credibility of Tim Russert. They're trying to discredit the credibility of Judith Miller, and they're trying to bring up evidence saying that they don't have the best memories either. The defense is also saying that the jury has to decide beyond a reasonable doubt, and they don't think that evidence is there. Libby's attorneys say, quote, "Libby hasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt that he intentionally made false statements." And that intent is a big question here.
Now, Libby was Vice President Cheney's top aide. Neither Cheney nor Libby testified in this trial. What's the White House's involvement in all of this?
Well, it's interesting because the prosecution says that the White House isn't part of anything, that there is not a larger scheme going on, that it was Libby's own decision to involve and to lie about and to cover up what he told reporters about Valerie Plame. The prosecution says, quote, there was no conspiracy. It's not because he's not trying to hide bad misconduct of others, but it's because of his own deeds, because he had to lie to save his job and because of the political ramifications. On the other hand, Libby and the defense are saying that he's the scapegoat, that Karl Rove, White House top advisor, was cleared of all of anything in this case. The vice president, Dick Cheney, was cleared of anything, and so that Libby is being used as the scapegoat.
And a scapegoat for what?
Well, remember, all of this took place in July of 2003. The U.S. had already invaded Iraq. And at this time, questions about the evidence used in the lead-up to the war are starting to come out. Some of that bad evidence included an investigation by Valerie Plame's husband, Joe Wilson. Those include aluminum tubes that were found in Niger. Joe Wilson says that they didn't exist, and that was the main evidence used for weapons of mass destruction that Iraq could obtain. And this is during the time that Joe Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, her name was leaked to the press. And remember, Libby isn't charged with leaking the information. He's charged with obstruction of justice, making false statements to the press, and also two counts of perjury for allegedly lying to the grand jury about his role in the outing of CIA agent Valerie Plame.
Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. She joined us today from the U.S. District Courthouse in D.C., where the I. Lewis Scooter Libby trial is wrapping up. The jury will begin deliberating the case tomorrow. The ongoing Iraq Occupation Project continued its efforts today in Massachusetts. The grassroots campaign aims to occupy key U.S. representatives' office to persuade them to vote against additional war funding. Chuck Rosina files this report.
This morning, the Occupation Project came to Congressman Ed Markey's office in Medford, Massachusetts. Local members of Veterans for Peace and Military Families Speak Out were also in attendance to show their support. The Iraq Occupation Project was initiated February 5th by Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Nate Goldschlag is a Vietnam veteran.
Congressman Markey has voted against some of these appropriations in the past. We wanted to target congressmen who we thought could be influenced to say, yes, I pledge that I will vote no this time. Congressman Markey is one of those. Congressman Meehan is another. We had thought about Capuano, but Capuano said he's voting no. Delahunt has said he's voting no. Barney Frank has said he's voting no. We're hoping that we can influence Representative Markey to also say he's voting no and to sign the pledge.
While the press conference went on inside, about a dozen supporters stood outside with signs and placards. Sarah has a son in the Marines.
This picture is a picture of him coming back from spending all of 2005 in Iraq, in Baghdad. And he's with the 3rd Infantry Division, Fort Stewart, Georgia, and he's getting ready for his second deployment. He's leaving in about 3 weeks. It's very hard because I know that he's okay now. I think the situation has just become so explosive. It's terrible. I'm just very, very sad for everybody who has a child there and for all the Iraqis who are getting killed. It's horrible. I don't want any more boys or young women to go to Iraq.
Congressman Markey has been receptive to the sit-in. He had his staff buy coffee and donuts and make them feel welcome, and he agreed to meet with the protesters tomorrow afternoon. He also released this statement today, quote, if the supplemental budget request is just another blank check to continue the war in Iraq, I will vote against it. Veterans for Peace and many other groups are doing good work, and I look forward to meeting with them, unquote. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina in Medford, Massachusetts.
A suicide bomber attacked a funeral in a Shia area of Baghdad today, killing 7 people and wounding 20 more. 6 people died when a chemical tanker was blown up in northern Baghdad, and at least 8 more people were killed in violence around the city. Iraqi military officials began the weekend trumpeting the success of their latest security operation in Baghdad, but the escalated violence is an inauspicious start to President Bush's escalation in Iraq, which is meant to calm the situation there. FSRN's Aaron Glantz has more.
More than 1.5 million soldiers have already served in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Many have already served two tours abroad and are now being asked to go again. Staff Sergeant Ron Cantu served in Iraq in 2004 and 2005 and was redeployed in December 2006. He spoke to FSRN from Baghdad.
In the beginning, I did think it was a good idea. I thought it was a great idea. It was more that every time that something exploded next to my vehicles or my convoy, or every time we got shot at or had to shoot at people, I started asking myself, like, what is it worth? What's going on here? What are we dying for?
President Bush plans to implement his troop escalation primarily by forcing soldiers like Ron Cantu to stay in Iraq longer, by refusing to allow them to leave the military when their commitment is up, and by reducing the amount of time soldiers have at home between deployments to just 7 months. Jeff Patterson is a former Marine who refused to fight in the first Gulf War. He's involved in a group called Courage to Resist.
I think it has been difficult all along for them to fight this war, and it gets more difficult every day. They're relying on people who have already served in Iraq once or twice. And a lot of these guys, when they first went to Iraq, they really thought that they were liberators. And on their second tour, you know, people are asking, why are you still here? Why have you come back? And now they're being faced a third time. Their family members are saying, well, I don't know you anymore. Who are you?
Democrats in Congress say they'll be able to block the troop escalation by putting conditions on the money they approve for the war. Congressman John Murtha, chair of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, told the website movecongress.org he will only vote to fund the war if soldiers' tours can't be extended, if troops receive proper training and equipment, and if they're given 1 year at home after each deployment.
They won't be able to continue. They won't be able to do the deployment. They won't have the equipment, they don't have the training, and they won't be able to do the work. There's no question in my mind. We have analyzed this, and we have come to the conclusion it can't be done. If you can't extend the troops, if you can't send troops over that haven't had a year at home, we see it's possible that some of those troops that would be sent over might only have 7 months at home. That's the kind of stuff we want to stop. That's not fair to the troops, not fair to the families, not fair to the country.
Staff Sergeant Ron Cantu says what particularly worries him is the sense that the Iraq War may never end, comparing it unfavorably to World War II.
In World War II, the soldiers knew that the quickest way home was straight through Berlin, Tokyo. Once they had that sheet that said, we surrender unconditionally, once their papers were signed, they were going home. But we don't have that this time around. There's just no representative force that's going to surrender to us. And our win conditions are in the hands of yet another entity.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
Social service and nonprofit agencies around the country struggle to find answers to how to meet the needs of the growing homeless population. Today, the Department of Housing and Urban Development announced plans to provide grants for agencies that provide support for the homeless. While these grants reflect a slight increase in funding, many feel more needs to be done. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Jean-Michel Girard knows the difference that federal monies can make in providing for the homeless population he serves. Girard's D.C.-based agency, the Community Council for the Homeless at Friendship Place, receives 25% of their funding from the federal government.
We offer outreach services on the street, so we find people right where they are. We engage them through techniques and through providing basic needs like water, blankets, food.
The Department of Housing and Urban Development has two types of homeless grants that agencies can apply for. These are known as Continuum of Care and Emergency Shelter Grants. Emergency shelter grants provide funds for homeless shelters and homeless prevention programs. The Continuum of Care grants, on the other hand, provide for permanent and transitional housing. The grants also fund services such as job training, health care, mental health counseling, substance abuse treatment, and child care. HUD's Deputy of Special Needs, Mark Hudson, describes the agency's approach to helping homeless people.
And we think of it really as a three-part process, where you look at persons on the streets, where we're providing outreach to them to get them off the streets. Second of all, into some housing, whether that's emergency or transitional, some kind of shorter-term housing that many communities use. And a third part is permanent housing. A person doesn't need to move through each of those cycles, but those are three elements that occur within continuums of care.
With the announcement today, HUD awarded 5,300 local homeless programs with funding, and the department says this will provide support for more than 150,000 individuals and families. HUD's Deputy Secretary Roy Bernardi.
We cannot stand aside and fail to act. The homeless situation must not become invisible or marginalized. And I think it says an awful lot about all of us in this country and about our humanity and as a people and as a nation on how we proceed.
Since 2001, HUD has awarded nearly $9 billion in homeless assistance nationwide. Agencies can bid on these grants through a competitive process. This year, HUD received over 5,600 applications from all over the United States. This year, HUD plans on spending $1.4 million on the grants. But those who serve the homeless say the funding is not enough. Michael Stoop, executive director from the National Coalition for the Homeless in Washington, D.C.
You could spend that amount in California and there would still be people homeless on the streets. Every unit of government should be doing something, and the federal government should be doing a hell of a lot more.
Both emergency shelter and continuum of care grants are awarded on a 1 to 2 year basis and can be renewed. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Mallison Nepal, who entered mainstream politics in April 2006 as part of the seven-party alliance that eclipsed King Gyanendra's rule, have emerged as the most powerful political force in the country. Basking in widespread mass acceptability, they decided to disarm their militias in exchange for sufficient seats in the national parliament and enough posts in the national government in the wake of an interim constitution ushered in on January 15. But critics say Maoists have failed to translate their vows to work for the welfare of marginalized groups into action. Groups like ethnic Indian origin Madhesis and Tibetan Mongoloid tribal fraternities have resorted to violent protests seeking justice, which has politically isolated the Maoists. Now, the Maoists have embarked on a new campaign to retrieve their sagging image, PC Dubey reports from Birganj, Nepal.
This February, the Maoists began a second people's war. Peaceful this time, to prevent pro-monarchy forces from stealing the hard-earned fruits of Nepal's new democracy. The Maoists are organizing daily meetings and rallies in every part of the country. Maoist leader Prachanda has emerged into the public eye after 25 years underground.
We intend to build a new Nepal, which means converting the few rulers for the past 250 years into the ruled, and the millions of the ruled into rulers.
Prachanda says the goal of this second war is to ensure that elections to the Constituent Assembly are held on schedule in May-June. The elections are seen as key to the drafting of a new constitution, which is expected to definitively end 250 years of feudal rule. Prachanda has, however, warned of hostile forces working against the country's march towards a new Nepal. But political analysts like Bhagyanath Gupta say the Maoist campaign is an effort to shore up their fading influence in southern Nepal, following recent protests by the Madhesi community demanding a federal system of governance and proportional representation in the national parliament on the basis of population. Madhesis number almost half of Nepal's 27 million people and contribute 75% of the national gross production. But they have been politically marginalized by Pahari elite for the past 250 years. During the insurgency, the Maoists enjoyed a strong Madhesi support. Maoists pledged to grant regional autonomy to the Madhesis, but since negotiating their entry into the political system last year, Maoists have done nothing to carry out their promise. Madhesis are suspicious that the Maoist leadership, like the leaders of all the parties now in government, is drawn from the elite Pahari community.
Prachanda is now developing clay feet. The Maoists are infected with a malaise of self-centeredness. Their talk of building a new Nepal by removing the king is only a mask to perpetuate their Pahari hegemony over the country. Madhesis can't be beguiled anymore.
Prachanda, however, denies having abandoned the Madhesi cause and pledges a renewed commitment to it.
The country is in a critical situation. Royalist, imperial, and foreign forces are conspiring to betray the Nepalese people's right to rule themselves. So our party has launched the campaign to foil these plans.
Upendra Yadav, chief of the Madhesi Rights Forum, MSF, which had spearheaded the mass Madhesi movement demanding greater representation, says their movement has no regressive ingredients.
We are Republicans. Our slogan is Federal Republic. Ending the monarchy and establishing a republic are the cardinal goals of our movement. So how can we be royalists? Actually, Maoists and Prime Minister Girja Koirala have saved the king. The pro-democracy movement had rejected the king last April. They are blaming us only to cover up their mistakes and black deeds.
Meena Gimhire, a Pahari social activist but a strong votary of the Madhesi cause, argues that the talk of a second people's war stems from the Maoist awareness that they are losing their popular appeal.
After joining the interim parliament, coupled with the ongoing demilitarization of their militias, Maoists are now like any other political party. But common masses have still not forgotten their politics of terror. So they are not ready to swallow Maoist bit of being democratic and are in a mood to reject them. The Madhesi movement vindicates this fact. This is why they have begun harping on the myth of a second people's war. Their strategy is to tell people that if they reject them, they would again take up arms, but such terror tactics are no longer going to sway masses. Maoists are doomed to be haunted by their past cult of killing for years to come.
Gimhire also accuses the Maoists of having a hidden agenda to collect money for the upcoming elections under the guise of this campaign. Maoist supporters like Ruchika Rani reject such accusations.
Our goal is not to frighten people, but to tell them that we're their true well-wishers. Other parties are in this merely for power. Our leaders are determined not to return to the jungle. The accusation that we are forcefully collecting donations is wrong. People are voluntarily offering donations. Everyone knows we are a party of the poor and can't run without people's support. Other parties are collecting funds too. But no one is pointing fingers at them.
The Maoist campaign is expected to end on February 25. They have already held rallies in half a dozen cities, including some in the Madhesi region. But the crowd at their rallies has been dismally thin, a further warning to their leaders that their standing among the people is on the wane. From Birganj in Nepal, I am P.C. Dua for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Tina Gisi and Monica Lopez. Our Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Antonio Ortiz and Eric Klein. You can listen to this newscast in its entirety online at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. We welcome your comments, questions, and story ideas. Just email us at comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado.